Welcome to Season 6 of the HPS Cast. I'm your host, Colbert Cannon. If you're new to the pod, HPS is a global investment firm. We manage approximately $85 billion in assets for a broad range of institutional investors. That capital is invested across private credit and public credit strategies. Each week, I sit down with key relationships to, partners of, and friends of the firm to learn from their experience, ask how that experience shapes their current roles, and give insights into HPS and how we operate. So with that, let's bring in our guest. Our guest this week was a longtime investment banker and later president and CEO of one of the world's largest pension investment funds. After attending Oxford undergrad and graduate work at Cambridge in the late 80s, he started his career at famed investment bank Goldman Sachs. He spent two decades at Goldman in London and in Hong Kong, and during his time there, he eventually became the head of Asia ex Japan Investment Banking and the vice chairman of Goldman Asia. In 2012, he left Goldman to join the Canadian Pension Plan Investment Board, or CPPIB, a truly massive organization that today manages over $500 billion in assets on behalf of Canadian retirees. He joined first as their president for Asia, and then later became their head of international, and finally became the president and CEO of CPPIB. He left almost 2 years ago and is now the founder and CEO of Opto Investments. So without any further ado, I'm thrilled to welcome in this week's HPS Cast guest, Mark Machen. Mark, welcome to the pod.
Great to be here. Thank you, Colbert.
Well, thank you for coming on. Now, Mark, let's begin as I like to at the beginning. Where did you grow up? Where are you from originally, Mark?
So I grew up in the northwest of England near Liverpool and Manchester in a county called Cheshire and in a very small village in the countryside called Norley.
I love it. Now, as an undergraduate and as a graduate, you studied physiological sciences and later medicine in grad school. What did you think you wanted to do during your college days?
Physiological sciences is undergrad medicine in Oxford speak. Oxford likes to call everything by a different special name, and that was the name of the undergrad degree course. So basically, when I was running around as a teenager in Cheshire, and I looked around at what were the most interesting and rewarding careers, it seemed there were only two out there in my sphere. One was being a lawyer. And to me, being a lawyer was standing up in court and defending criminals. And the second was being a doctor. And that seemed pretty interesting. You need to know everything about the human body, everything that could go wrong with the human body. And that's what I applied to do at Oxford. I was lucky to get in. But while I was at Oxford, my eyes were open to the vast array of other things that are out there in the world that are interesting.
So you got derailed from that original path. How did we end up at Goldman Sachs originally?
Yeah, so I mean, it took a while. I decided once I started that I should finish. So I did my undergrad at Oxford. I did a year of research in Australia, and then I did my graduate at Cambridge. And I believed, you know, I'd only have one career. I could see my medical career stretching out ahead of me, and it's a fabulous profession. It's really interesting. It's really worthy. But I'd also got really interested in business and finance and economics and how the world works and ticks and why companies exist and why businesses exist. And so I was looking around for companies that would be open-minded enough to give me a job and teach me about that world at the same time. And I applied to a few banks. Goldman Sachs, I'd say, was open-minded enough to take a punt on someone who had no financial background but could work hard. And that's how I ended up there.
Longtime listeners certainly have heard me say that I literally knew nothing about finance when I stepped in the door at Goldman Sachs in the late 90s. So I'm glad to see that it wasn't just me. Tell me about your first job then, Mark. It was in the London office, I imagine, or where did you start off?
I started off in the London office. I applied to do M&A because that was the sort of cool thing back at the time I joined in 1991. Actually ended up getting the job in corporate finance or global finance, as it was called at the time. And it was fascinating. We did both financings and M&A and all sorts of other, you know, some project finance work, and worked all over Europe from Scandinavia to working on, you know, things in North Africa and Greece. And it was one of those moments in the evolution of Goldman Sachs where you got an unreasonable amount of responsibility. You're just thrown in the deep end. You're thrown in with maybe one more senior person or a couple of more senior people. And, you know, and then someone gets busy and you are in the meeting running it, you know, 1 or 2 years into your career. And it's just deeply immersive way of learning and taking on responsibility.
So Goldman was sort of notorious in those days for telling people to move places more than just having people opt in. Did you raise your hand for the move out to Hong Kong and Asia, or were you told that it was time to move to Hong Kong?
No, I did. Yeah, that was actually quasi-voluntary. As I was coming through my third year, the principal investing area reached out to me to say, you know, would you like to join in London? About a month later, I got a call from one of the senior folks who'd moved out to Asia and a couple other people had said, we're building up a business in Asia. Would you be interested in coming out? And so, yeah, it was a request rather than a tell me to do it. I had one other really interesting opportunity in Europe and the sort of growing technology and media and telecom area. But I decided that Asia was something I knew nothing about. It was a huge hole in my understanding of the world. And, you know, I'd go there for a couple of years and, you know, learn something. And then I could always go back to Europe.
I'm always interested in different business cultures. How hard was that switch from London to, you know, mid to late 90s Hong Kong?
It was really hard for a couple of reasons. One is that Goldman Sachs went from its greatest year ever in 1993 to one of its worst years ever in 1994. So that was one thing. The second thing was when I said Goldman was trying to break into Europe and trying to take market share from the European banks. In Asia, it was even more difficult at that stage. And a lot of the time we were going around basically explaining, first of all, what an investment bank was. A lot of the clients in Asia at that time had not really understood what an investment bank is. And there was a culture of banks coming along and lending money. We didn't lend money. So that we had to explain what that was. And then we had to explain what Goldman Sachs was. And the final thing that happened around that time is China's inflation went up a lot and they raised interest rates, market shut down. So there'd been a lot of build of the China markets and optimism in 1993, 1994, 5, it all shut down. So it was a tough time.
So despite those challenges, you know, you spent two decades at Goldman. By the end of your time there, you were the vice chairman of all of Asia. Tell me about that role and how you, what does that mean at a firm like Goldman Sachs? How did you spend your time?
Yeah, so the main role I had was co-head of investment banking. And I grew up on the capital market side, so I could do investment banking and understand, you know, I could know the private side of what was going on in the world. And I could see all the public stuff, be on the trading floor, understand the public side of markets. And that seemed like a fantastic combination of things. So I grew up in that in Asia. I became co-head of equity capital markets in 2000. We then pushed together all the financing businesses and corporate derivative businesses to create financing groups around the world. I did that in Asia first and was head of the financing group. And then I took over the leadership of investment banking and financing in around 2004-5. Last 3 years of my time, I spent actually onshore in China. The China business had become more than half of the overall business. And that was fascinating overall, where I was the senior person on the ground in China.
You were in Beijing or where were you?
In Beijing. We had about 500 people onshore at that time in China overall, the businesses.
Well, as you say, Mark, you had a longevity and a stability there that is unique. To what do you credit that? How did you have that sort of longevity?
I mean, I worked hard, a lot of hardworking people. One of the people I admired way back, going back a bit to my original equity capital markets days, was Eric Dobkin, who is known as the legend who basically invented capital markets on Wall Street. And he had an absolute passion for excellence, perfection, and winning. That really drew me to capital markets in the first place. And at the time, it was a massive economic engine of the firm, of the business. And, you know, the types of deals that we did were groundbreaking for countries and markets.
If there's a through line from your time at London to Hong Kong too, the Goldman needing to prove itself and just working harder and being better than the other ones who had been in there longer, I always think is part of the theme. Okay, so 2011-2012 timeframe, Mark, you decide to leave Goldman to join CPPIB to run their Asian business. Before we talk about CPPIB, why was that the right time to move on from Goldman Sachs?
Yeah, well, going back to the beginning, Corbett, when I thought about joining investment banking, you know, I thought I'd do it for a couple of years and truly thought I'd go back to medicine. And I was stunned to find, to look up from my desk effectively 20 years later and find I'm still doing investment banking. So around that time, you know, I mean, the headhunters would call, people would call for various different things. And I always used to tell the financial headhunters, look, you know, if you get Bill Gates to call me, I'll leave tomorrow and I'll run the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. You know, I thought that was an amazing organization, amazing mission. And that was sort of combine some leadership capability with doing some good in the world. So a woman called me one day, and I literally just opened my 20-year gifts from Goldman. I got my clock and I put it on the shelf, and the phone rings, and it's a woman from a headhunting firm. He says, "Mark, you know, look, it's not Bill Gates, but if you took this offer, then you could wake up every morning knowing you're doing something worthwhile for 20 million people. You know, how does that sound?" And I said, "Very good. You got me interested. What is it?" And she said, "Well, it's a pension fund." And I said, "Well, that doesn't sound very interesting." And she said, "It's called CPPIB." And I said, "Well, I've never heard of it." She said, "Well, look, you got to meet this guy who's going to be the next CEO. He's the CEO in waiting. He's, you know, fascinating, dynamic guy. And you have to meet him. And he's in Hong Kong next week." And I said, "Okay, all right. So I'm open to meeting." And so when I was in Hong Kong following week, I met Mark Wiseman, who was my predecessor in running CPPIB. We hit it off immediately. And then I met the rest of the senior management team. David Dennison was the CEO at the time, who I just thought was just a first-class leader and human being. So I thought, maybe this is it. This is fascinating. This is an organization that has one purpose, which is to invest money in the best possible way, and has a good purpose. It is on behalf of 20 million people. You know, they're not.
And let's unpack that, Mark. Exactly what does CPPIB do for those less familiar?
Yeah, so CPPIB manages the money that is not immediately needed to pay pensions for Canadians. And so all people outside of Quebec in Canada pay into their national pension fund, the CPP. It comes out of their salary. They pay it every month, and it goes to support them in retirement. So it's a national monopoly system for the basic pension system.
So, Mark, tell me about your first role there. So you went in to lead their Asian business. What was that? What were your responsibilities?
Yeah, well, I said to Mark Wiseman, "Look, you know, I could be the next Warren Buffett in investing, but I don't know that. You know, I've been on the advisory side up to now. But what I can do is keep you out of trouble in Asia." At that time, I'd been around for 17 years in the region. So we had about 20 people in the Hong Kong office at the time. And the business really was investing in private equity funds and hedge funds in the region, led by two very capable people and a real estate team as well. And it grew from there. So I think now the Asia team must be around, you know, 160 people or so. And it became an increasing portion of the investment of the fund overall. So when I left, we were over $500 billion, of which over a third was in Asia. So it grew a lot.
So Mark, you mentioned this. You make this transition from a primarily advisory role at Goldman, having gotten that advice in London years ago, to an investing role at CPPIB. How did you go about learning about asset classes for investment that you wouldn't have touched as an investment banker?
Yeah, so credit Mark again. You know, he put me on all the investment committees for the fund. So I was on the direct deal investment committees. I was on the portfolio construction committees. And, you know, I asked a lot of dumb questions and asked a lot of people a lot of dumb questions and read a lot. And, you know, it was a very thoughtful process. I say, well, one of the beauties of the place was it was, you know, an independent board and management team left to its own devices to determine what is the best possible way of constructing this long-term pool of investable assets.
All right. So then you then become the head of international at CPPIB. Were you still based in Asia at that point, or did you move back to Canada then?
No. So I was based in Asia, and whenever anybody asked me, you know, what I might be interested in, I always said I didn't want to do a global role because it sounded like a nightmare, you know, flying around all over the world. So, you know, again, Wiseman is one of the most persuasive people I've ever met and talked me into it. The only thing I managed to persuade him is me looking after the U.S. was sort of crazy. So we agreed to draw the line at the Mexican border. And I said, look, you know, if I'm covering Latin America from Hong Kong, which is a long way away, then the first thing I'm going to do is hire a head of Latin America. So I hired a head of Latin America, headed Asia myself. And it was fascinating for me to actually go to, you know, it's the first time I'd spent any time in Latin America. I'd never been. And, you know, learning about those markets was a whole new world for me as well.
All right. So by 2016, you have been successful in these roles. You become the CEO and president of CPPIB. During your tenure, if public reports, if I read them correctly, would suggest you generated something like an 11% annual return during your tenure there. That's hard to do on $500, let alone managing $500 billion. When you take a step back, to what do you credit, you know, CPPIB's and your success and stewardship there?
I sat on top of an amazing group of people. So we had 2,000 extraordinarily talented people. And that was one of the things that I don't think a lot of people realize. I certainly didn't realize before that the Canadian pension funds could attract such talent. But as a hirer in Toronto, which is a great city, we could pick up the best talent because we were the biggest and most interesting investing business in town. And so we could pick up, you know, fantastic talent. We could put that talent in different places around the world. And then one of the things that we managed to do, you know, during the time I was there is pick up extraordinary talent in all these other places in the world, particularly people who just want to invest and they don't want to fundraise and they want dependability. So we could pick up particularly people who'd been, for example, on a hedge fund platform that for no fault of their own had just, you know, disappeared or changed strategy. So we could, you know, say, look, you've been unlucky. You've been on a couple of hedge fund platforms that haven't worked out. Come and join us. We have half $1 trillion. It's going to keep growing.
Yeah, that is a unique pitch, isn't it? I've always been impressed by how CPPIB uses its scale to its advantage. Tell me about how that all works.
The one sort of competitive advantage that it is hopefully a lasting one for CPPIB is this partnership, being a great partner and being there for the long term. You know, there's a very predictable set of inflows and growth of the fund over many years. So there would be a desire to collaborate on ideas, to collaborate on investment opportunities. On the fund side, obviously, you know, one of the mathematical benefits is when you invest in a fund, no matter how hard you negotiate, there's still fees and carry, which you're paying out. And we paid out a lot of fees and carry. And so in order to, you know, lower the drag of that, if you can invest, do big co-sponsorship investment with no fee, no carry, then that significantly reduced the fee drag and therefore increased the after-cost returns. And so that was the goal as well. We primarily invested in funds. The rest was all done in-house. We had about 52 different investment strategies. You know, infrastructure and real estate and the real assets businesses generally were investing directly, but the private equity business and the hedge fund business were ones where, you know, we believed that there was just such a extraordinary talent base that we knew it would be incremental to our returns.
So, Mark, you were the CEO there for about 5 years, a little less than 2 years ago, if I have my math right, you decided to move on. Tell me what you've been up to since. We've heard some interesting press about Opto Investments. I would love to hear what you're doing these days.
Yeah, so as I was coming up to my 5 years at CPPIB, I called a handful of people very confidentially around the world who I've admired and said, look, I'll probably step down after 5 years. So if you've got something interesting, then, you know, let me know. And Joe Lonsdale, who I'd got to know as a very interesting brain and venture capitalist, I hadn't realized that one of his passions was alternative investing. So Joe called me January 2021 and said, hey, I've got this interesting idea. What do you think? Do you want to, you know, what are your thoughts? You know, maybe when you retire, you can be an advisor or something. And then over the following months, I thought, you know, this sounds absolutely fascinating. I'm going to dive in, be a co-founder, be CEO, and drive the business. That's what I decided to do in the end.
So, Mark, you've built businesses before, right, and grown in new geographies, but this is different when you're building something from the ground up. Tell me about that experience and how hard that is compared to your previous roles.
Yeah, well, it reminds me somewhat of the early days of the smaller capital markets businesses that I was in. And that small, close-knit team of people really driven by winning, driven by creating the best solution for clients. You know, that really inspired me back then. You know, we're about 40, 45 people. There's a whole dimension of people that I've not had the pleasure of working with before. There's software engineers that are building a really fantastic piece of software. There's product people, there's design people. And then we're picking up wealth managers, particularly the independent RIA channel. And that's a world that I'm learning fast about.
So Goldman, large organization, CPPIB, large organization. What do you miss about these businesses of scale that you spent the majority of your career in?
You know, I don't know what I really miss yet. I mean, one of the challenges with any big organization is the bureaucracy that builds up. It's human nature to put processes in place. And frankly, when I was at CPPIB, I put a lot of processes in place, which I'm grateful that I did when we hit the COVID crisis. So that's necessary, but at the same time,
it's a double-edged sword.
As a small company, one of the delights is having a lot less bureaucracy. You can move a lot more quickly. You know, what do I miss? I mean, I certainly miss the extraordinary perch that I had at CPPIB where I could see anything in the world. We had leverage on top of the funds. We had about $650 billion of investable capital. If I landed in any country in the world, I was everybody's best friend.
Everybody picks up your call.
Every top business, the prime minister and minister of finance of every country, you know, wanted us to invest. I had the best network of understanding what was truly going on in the world and where we should be deploying our capital. I miss that to some extent, but I don't need to do it forever. And who knows? You know, we'll see. In a few years' time, we grow to this to something sizable.
That's right. I love it. Well, listen, we'll be cheering on your successes. And if history is any indicator, I look forward to hearing about Opto's success over the next couple of years. With that, Mark, let's move to the last segment of the podcast. And this is something, Mark, we like to call best ideas. So where we offer up something that's added value in our lives recently. We call it best ideas because it's our goal as investors to always maximize exposure to them. Mark, as our guest, I'm going to ask you to go first. What's your best idea this week?
First one is go travel and actually get on the ground in different places, you know, and go on the ground for a significant amount of time. There's no substitute for actually visiting places and visiting different countries and cultures and actually being there. So if you want to truly understand what's going on in any country, you name it, getting on the ground is absolutely best thing to do. Your second thing, you know, on books, there's a fascinating book which gives a perspective on sanctions called The Economic Weapon. It came out in January this year. And it just a reminder, you know, reading this book about the complexity of supply chains and the financial system even back then, and you know, good and bad lessons that have been learned over the years. So I think it's a really eye-opening book.
That's a great recommendation. Yeah, The Economic Weapon by Nicholas Mulder. That's a fantastic recommendation. I've not read it yet and look forward to it, Mark. Well, great. So then my best idea, as listeners know, I always like to be inspired by the guests of the week. Mark, as you've heard, spent the bulk of his career in Asia. And while most of that was, in fairness, outside of Japan, I'm going to take some artistic liberty this week and recommend a great TV show I watched recently set in Japan. So my best idea this week is the show Tokyo Vice on Apple TV. Tokyo Vice is a true story. It was from a book written by a reporter from Missouri who moves to Japan post-college to work for one of Tokyo's most prominent newspapers. It's produced and has episodes directed by Michael Mann. And so it's just, you know, beautifully shot. Stars Ansel Elgort, Ken Watanabe, and Rachel Keller, a young actress in a star-making turn. The reporter gets put on the crime beat and gets very deep investigating the Yakuza and organized crime. It is thrilling. It's fascinating. If I have any gripe, it ends season one on a bit of a cliffhanger. And so I legitimately cannot wait for more of it to come out. But my best idea this week then, in honor of our guest, is Tokyo Vice, a captivating show that just happens to be at least mostly true. Mark, have you checked that one out yet?
I have not, but I will do.
You'll enjoy it, especially with your history there. So Mark, with that, time to say goodbye for the week. We so appreciate the time, appreciate you coming on, and look forward to hearing more about Opto Investment's success in the coming years.
Fabulous. Well, thank you, Colbert. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks again to our guest, Mark Machen. Check out our show notes to learn more about Mark and his work. You'll also find a link to Mark's best idea, the book The Economic Weapon by Nicola Mulder, and to mine, the HBO Max TV series Tokyo Vice. This podcast was brought to you by At Will Media with HPS Investment Partners. Please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen.